Welcome to the Lean Health Tech Podcast, where industry professionals discuss trends and topics where efficiency, healthcare, and technology meet. My name is Taryn Shipley, and I'm your host. Our guest speaker today is Dr. John Hart. Dr. Hart is the CMO of Affirm Health and author of the book Value in Healthcare. He edits and writes for the content platform Business of Primary Care. He has served at executive levels for payers, health systems, and large physician practices, leading efforts to create value in healthcare. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Hart.
Well, thanks for having me, Taryn. I appreciate it and glad to be here.
Today's topic is quality over quantity, the ongoing quest for value-based care. In 1967, the American Academy of Pediatrics created the PCMH, the patient-centered medical home concept, which promotes value-based care. In 2006, authors Michael Porter and Elizabeth Olmsted Teesberg coined the term value-based care in their book, Redefining Healthcare. So value-based care has been around for over 50 years. What is value-based care and why is it such a hot topic right now?
Value-based care has been around over 90 years, not necessarily called that. Mr. Kaiser of the Kaiser Shipyards out west started an employer-based plan for his shipyards when they were building ships pre and during World War II. And I would actually put that as the start of value-based care, because what he was trying to do as an employer-sponsored plan was get the most bang for his buck, create the most value for healthcare to be delivered to his employees and making it convenient for them so that they could, frankly, get back to work quicker, but that they would have a good experience and that the costs would be acceptable and not over the top. So I actually would put it back 90 years. You know, interesting too, in the 60s, was when Lyndon Johnson started his war on poverty. And you mentioned the PCMH movement in pediatrics. A couple of years before that, they also legislated the federally qualified health centers, which, you know, are primary care clinics. And they were first established in 1965. And their mission was very similar to what was put forth in the Affordable Care Act earlier this century, in terms of trying to deliver the highest quality of care, in this case, to folks who can't necessarily afford it. So it's been around a while, you know, really for the past century, in spite of Mr. Kaiser and other things, healthcare has been delivered through a volume-based model, meaning the more people you can see in the day, the more bills you can drop, the more money you can make. Value-based care isn't about cheaper care or denied care, which is kind of where it went with the HMOs in the late 70s and the 80s and early 90s, because they were trying to do a lot of things that we're doing now, but they were trying to do it without the computer, the computing capabilities to be able to handle big data and really find opportunities of improving quality and outcomes while making costs appropriate. But anyway, it's not about cheap care. It's not about denied care. And in fact, you mentioned Michael Porter. He actually emphasized that in his book in 2006. Interestingly, though, even though he made that point about it not being cheaper, he went on to say that, you know, high value care should actually cost less in the long run than low value care. And so it's based on creating value in healthcare delivery.
If it's been around for 90 years, I mean, that's almost a century. Why is it such a hot topic today? It seems like 10 years ago, primarily people were fee for service. Why is the pivot to value-based care only happening now?
That's a great question and a great point, and for a couple of reasons. One, things change slowly in healthcare. We think about medical advances and innovations in treating certain diseases, and some of those happen very quickly. But overall, the changes that occur in how healthcare is delivered, that's been really slow. I mean, you think about electronic medical records. The first EMR was invented in the 60s, 1967, I think, something like that. EMRs didn't really even start to creep over the, you know, peak at us until the late 90s. It just took that long, partly because for technology to catch up, because most physicians' offices didn't have computers. That's one example. The other is, you know, healthcare has been driven for the last century by hospitals and health systems. And unfortunately, one of the things that's happened with that is the focus on sick care and rescue care. So that kind of fed into the fee-for-service model of Mrs. Jones has this condition. I'm treating her for this condition. I'm dropping a bill for that condition. Then I move on to the next thing. As opposed to, you know, really with value-based care, it is outcomes-based. What happens over longitudinally with Mrs. Jones becomes much more important than what happened in that little episode. But then the other piece on it, and I mentioned it talking about HMOs, I don't think we really had the capabilities of finding the best ways to deliver healthcare until our computing capabilities sort of caught up with the ideas. I mean, if you think about in the 90s, most folks were still on paper charts. And if you're trying to figure out, you know, how you're going to impact emergency department visits or inpatient visits or diabetes control or chronic kidney disease, and you're trying to aggregate all this data on paper and then maybe build a spreadsheet and work, it was just too cumbersome, which is frankly, again, why I think the mass change to HMOs, to health maintenance organizations, failed at that time. I'm going to put the answer of why is it really coming to the forefront now? And I would say really over the last 15 years, since about 2010, when the conversations started around the Affordable Care Act and when the government, you know, they passed that and a lot of it dealt with the triple aim and then the quadruple aim of, you know, we want to get patients as healthy as they can at the appropriate price and get them good experience. And then the quadruple aim is when we added in providers and physicians and their experience into that. But that got people thinking about it more. And then we had the capabilities of working with it. And really, I think to understand the whole concept of creating value in healthcare, the first place you have to go to is you have to understand the value equation. And I'm happy to talk about that unless you had some follow-up questions on what we were just talking about with the time frame.
You actually just read my mind. I was going to bring up the idea that value is kind of an abstract concept. What one person deems valuable, another person might not see that same piece of care as valuable. So with it being so subjective, how do you measure value? How can you prove that a healthcare organization is practicing value-based care when there's not a quantitative measure?
Yeah, and Taryn, it's an interesting concept. And it's the funny thing is, it's an equation that we do in our brains multiple times in the day, whenever we're reaching for our wallet or whenever we're going to order something online or whatever. We run through the value equation in our head. And when I'm speaking of the value equation, what I'm talking about is value equals, and then on the right side of that equation, in parentheses, you have quality divided by cost. And then the quotient of that division of quality over cost is multiplied, in my mind, multiplied. Some people say it's added, but anyway, by experience. You either add experience or multiply by experience. So quality over cost multiplied by experience equals value. You know, if I'm searching on an online shopping platform for a specific item, I'm going to look at, okay, well, how well is that put together? What are the components of that? What's the cost of it? What's it going to cost me? How quickly can I get it delivered? Well, I'm looking at the reviews to see, oh, this company always, you know, comes through with what they say they're going to do, or no, it's a big hassle and on and on. And my experience is going to be less. So then I choose my product. I just did a calculation of the value equation in my head on the fly and chose what I felt was going to be the best value to get that product. The problem is because we've been delivering healthcare in a volume-based construct where it's really, you know, volume equals how many you do and what do you get paid for that? That's volume. Because we've been in that construct, healthcare has been exempt from having to create value or feel that value is created in any way, which frankly is where Michael Porter ended up writing that book in 2006 because he recognized that, oh my gosh, this not only is our healthcare system not creating value, the way that we do it is actually destroying value. It's the opposite of what's happening. So in those components of that value equation, and again, there's not a discrete field or a number that you can necessarily put into these things to get the answer. So it is still kind of squishy, but I think about quality as, you know, it reflective of the outcomes based nature of value-based care. So outcomes are important, but it's so much more. It's also access. Do people have access to care? Without that, you can't accomplish quality. Prevention, things that are done to prevent illness. And I would throw in with that early detection as well, like mammograms and colonoscopies and things like that, you know. And in fact, some people just think about quality in that regard. They just think about HEDIS measures. The NCQA has put forth certain measures of these are the things you need to do. And a lot of folks just think about that as quality, but that's not it either. And then the last piece of quality, the component that I would put in quality, is care coordination. How well does care get coordinated? Because if you've got a lot of really smart people, physicians and nurses and case managers and pharmacists and therapists and social workers and mental health professionals, all really top of the heap in their specific discipline, but none of them talk to each other, your quality is going to be negatively impacted.
I have an analytical mindset. So quality over cost times experience, to me, that makes perfect sense. It is still a bit squishy with the cost being different because is that from the perspective of the patient, from the perspective of the health system or the payer, it might be slightly different from each of those points of view.
Absolutely. And you actually, so when I define cost, you actually split it up into the three things that I define cost with. The cost is price, which the payer has to deal with that in most cases in the United States, not the patient, but then also affordability. And that's where the patient comes into the mix, because even at the price that's been negotiated, if it's a high deductible plan or whatever, and it's not affordable to the patient, then that's going to have a negative impact. And then from a health system perspective, or even a large physician practice perspective, there's opportunity cost. It's a huge question with health systems, because if you're a health system who makes your money, you pay your employees based upon how many people are in your hospital beds, heads in beds, and you're going to start going down an outcomes-based revenue stream where one of your goals is to keep people out of hospital beds, then you have to start, unfortunately, and this is what health systems do, have to start weighing that opportunity cost with what they want to do potentially with value-based care.
I think for me, another tricky thing to grasp with value-based care is there's a very fine line between over-screening for preventive services and preventive care versus not screening enough and only providing sick care. So can you elaborate a little bit about on finding that sweet spot?
The sweet spot, and it actually exists not only in screening for prevention or screening for early detection, but it's in the care of chronic conditions. So let's talk about screening. For instance, there is a risk of overscreening because you can lead people down a path of false positives and take them, you know, let's say a mammogram, for instance, that's read as positive potential cancer, biopsies happen, it's really not cancer, there's a complication to biopsy, things like that. So then a lot of money gets spent with no great impact on that patient. In fact, maybe negative impact. Now, the good news is a lot of studies have been done to show that when you do colorectal cancer screening, when you do breast cancer screening, you actually do find things earlier in their course more often than you find false positives, so that you do impact cost and outcome with those. I think a bigger question, and this is the one that has the impact on health systems and hospitals more, is dealing with, well, CMS calls them ambulatory care conditions or ambulatory conditions. I call them fragile chronic conditions. I don't want to call them diseases. Let's just call them conditions. I've used the word 83 times now, but we'll just stick with that. They're conditions that people have that are chronic health circumstances that, like diabetes, like heart failure, COPD, emphysema, heart disease of non-heart failure types. But those kind of things where you can work effectively to optimize health and well-being on those people to keep them out of trouble more often by seeing them more often, by managing their medications with them, getting patient engagement to be able to do all the right things, to follow, like heart failure or diabetes, to follow the metrics that they have at home, whether it's their weight or their oxygen saturation or their blood sugar, to catch things early and intervene early before they crash and burn and end up in the hospital. And that's the piece that seems to have the most negative impact on hospitals and health systems. I've had hospital leaders sit around a table and talk to me about demand destruction that occurs when you take better care of patients with these conditions. And my jaw dropped when I first heard that. I was like, well, you know, because you usually think about demand destruction. We hear about it all the time, especially around petroleum products. When electric cars come out or people start biking more, that or there's things that decrease people driving their vehicles, there's demand destruction of oil. And so then they have to raise the prices or they figure out, you know, what are they going to do with that? I've heard that term from healthcare executives too, in talking about, well, if you're going to take better care of these heart failure patients and these diabetes patients and these COPD patients, how are you going to make up for the demand destruction of them not needing to come to my hospital and be in a hospital bed?
My mind actually went to the opposite thought of, we need more primary care visits to better and more effectively manage these patients. And we don't have enough primary care resources. We already have access issues.
Absolutely. And so that's part of the tension with value-based care right now. You're exactly right, Taryn, that there's not nearly enough primary care physicians and other providers who can do the tasks, some of the tasks of primary care in our nation to be able to meet the current needs. And so we do need to increase those. It's really there's a twofold answer to that. One is training more people to do primary care, whether it's primary care physicians or, again, nurse practitioners or physician assistants or others. I mean, shoot, there's pharmacists, PharmDs out there now engaged in some primary care. And in the UK, they're actually having PharmDs get heavily engaged in the provision of primary care. I'm not advocating for that necessarily, but it could be a people problem. We don't have enough people. And I do think that plays into it some. But I think another aspect of it is that we're not utilizing the resources that we currently have effectively to meet the needs of the primary care needs in our country. We've got docs and providers spending so much time on either dealing with the complications of chronic conditions or dealing with sick care and having them churn and burn the patients through their office on a fee-for-service model, because they know that, okay, well, if I can just see three more sore throats today, that's going to help me pay the light bill, as opposed to really working to figure out what can we do to keep these people healthier. So yes, we need more primary care resources available and access to those resources. We need to better reconcile how those resources are used and what we're doing with them. Again, because if we had physicians who were on a regular basis, and let's just talk about ideal state in my brain right now. If we had physicians who all of their patients with diabetes had continuous glucose monitoring systems that fed into through their phones into a system that the practice had somebody monitoring at all times, and to know when Mr. Smith or Mrs. Jones might be starting to get into trouble, and can actually reach out to them, or if they haven't reached out first, to say, hey, my blood sugar is climbing, what do I need to do? Likewise, heart failure patients who their weight is being monitored through a Bluetooth-enabled device that sends that information to the care team so that they can alert the physician that Mr. Ramirez's weight has gone up 2 pounds since yesterday. I've reached out to him. It turns out he had a cured ham for dinner last night. We had him take an extra Lasix pill, and he's going to check in with us tomorrow. Or he needs to come in and be seen so that we can nip this problem in the bud and not let it fully bloom into some sort of problem that lands Mr. Ramirez into the hospital.
You really need to stop reading my mind, because my next question was, can technology be used as a resource to bridge that people resource gap? And it sounds like what you're describing is exactly that. If we better leverage technology as part of the care team, essentially, we can reduce some of the burden on the clinicians.
Absolutely. So, and I want to, let's talk about technology, but I want to start that conversation with my firm belief that success in healthcare depends on the appropriate application of technology and relationship. Because I think it's important to know and to note that we can't tech ourselves out of the need for human-to-human contact and relationship. That still has to be a big part of medical practice and healthcare delivery. But we have not even really begun to tap, I don't think, the resources that technology can bring to us. There's at least, gosh, 5 or 6 different things that technology brings to the table. To start with, and in the context of value-based care, one of the things you want to know if you're in a value-based care arrangement with a payer is, who are your patients that are most at risk? What's the stratification of risk of your patients? Technology can do that for you through data analysis. There's been, we call it AI now, but frankly, we've been using risk stratification tools with a high C score to comb through all the discrete fields of data and tell us who's at most risk for a problem over the next 12 months if we don't do something about it. So, but technology can help set the table on, who do we need to reach out to first and foremost? Not that we're not going to talk to the other people too, but who is it that's at most risk? Secondly, with technology is patient engagement. Again, these tools have been around for a while. They're getting more used more and more, but not only, I think most of us are familiar with when you get a doctor's appointment and then they send you a text message and, oh, why don't you go ahead and do your pre-registration now? But even beyond that, engaging patients who have chronic conditions. A great example here is mental health and even behavioral health when you're talking about like smoking cessation or addictions and things like that. But mental health with depression and anxiety, for at least the last 15 years, electronic devices and phones have been used to engage patients, ask, to push questions to them and receive and to pull answers from them to get that information and to get them more engaged in their care and what's going on. Same thing happens in diabetes, heart failure, COPD. We touched on access with technology, and I think you're spot on that the days of the front door to the office being the only way you access your physician, I think are long gone. And they need to be. That still needs to be an access point. The telephone still needs to be an access point, and frankly, is technology to a certain degree, though we take it for granted. But outside of the brick and mortar, where technology can help in access, one is telemedicine. Telemedicine got a big shot in the arm, no pun intended, through COVID, because people couldn't go see their physician. So you know, we changed rules, we changed payment policies, we made that happen. But, you know, Taryn, here's another example of technology being so slow to catch up. I was working with a residency program in the late 90s, and we had, I was on faculty, and we had a Center for Rural Health. This was in Indiana. And we were, this was 1997, we were developing, we had a working telemedicine model. Now it was PC based on a desk because we didn't have smartphones and we couldn't have even imagined at that time what a smartphone could do for us from a telemedicine perspective. But we had it available because in rural areas, in particular in Indiana or even more rural areas, you might have to drive 1,500 miles to see a specialist. And so it was easier for patients to come to the office, have a video visit, use a telemedicine stethoscope, send the EKG reports, all that kind of stuff. The reason it never caught on is nobody paid for it. And so patients didn't really want it because they didn't want to have to pay extra for it. And there was still some folks developing this in the background over the last 25 years. And so then when COVID hit and the opportunity came, they were ready and they had it. And then people realized, oh, you know what? This is a good thing. And it does increase the ability to access healthcare. And a lot of people don't think of this as an access point, but I do. And that's remote patient monitoring. It's because it can be a two-way communication platform. But if you're, if you've got a patient who is willingly sharing their weight or their blood pressure, or their oxygen saturation or their blood sugar with a physician's office or a provider and fielding questions or knowing when to reach out, then that becomes an access point. The fourth area, and I kind of mentioned it with risk stratification, but it's really data analysis and the ability for us, again, and this is, I think, again, the difference between HMOs and today, the ability of us to look at huge amounts of data and say, well, you know what? Actually, it looks like all of our patients who take this type of blood pressure medicine and come in X number of times a year seem to do better on an overall basis than the ones that are doing it differently. But to be able to just look at trends, to look at all the different types of knee injections that people can get for arthritis with hyaluronic acid, you know, to help with knee arthritis pain, and which one of those does the best job at preventing a knee replacement surgery down the line. An office can do that on their own, whereas, you know, that used to be something that only a large academic center or somebody could do on, and find the answers to. The last piece, and this is the most challenging piece and frankly the most frustrating piece for me, and that is interoperability between electronic platforms for communication and coordination of care. When electronic medical records, I mentioned, you know, that it was developed in the 60s, but it was truly in the late 90s when some real effort went forth in that. And it was after a JAMA article on medical errors. And somebody said, you know what, if we had electronic medical records that could talk to, they could all talk to each other and everybody on the care team would know what was going on with this patient and what had happened with them and what medicines they were, that we could avoid so many medical errors. And so we started down this path of electronic medical records. But unfortunately, in most of the things that we've built to carry information in healthcare, we've cloistered them off from each other. So they can't, they don't talk and they can't, they don't communicate well with each other. And we keep, you know, passing laws and regulations about, well, now we've got to, you know, you've got to have a fire connection and you've got to be able to work with other EMRs and things like that. But anyway, if we can crack that nut in a way that doesn't break the bank for the big EMR companies, if we can solve that issue to where people in healthcare can communicate with each other and can coordinate care in a dynamic, effective way, then frankly, that's going to be healthcare turbocharged when that happens.
So the underlying mindset of VBC is adopting a long-term sustainability mindset of ensuring the patients are cared for in the long run, not just they come in, stick a Band-Aid on them, send them home. We'll deal with the next emergency when it pops up. We really want to ensure that their chronic diseases are managed well. We want to prevent the chronic diseases in the first place. And these are all kind of squishy things, right? And I'll go back to the idea that I'm a very analytical person and I like some concrete concepts, like physically, what can you change to go from a fee-based model to a more value-based care model? And it sounds like from all the things you're saying, there are two pillars that keep popping up, and that's technology and analytics. It sounds like to me, value-based care organizations might be identified by leveraging technology more than others and having a great grasp and use for their analytics. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, I would. And I think, again, I think there's a, you could say the two pillars, but I think there's probably a three-legged stool there, because I still think you need human relationship to make both of those two, the technology and the analytics, to for them to be effective in the delivery of healthcare. You still need to know who Mrs. Jones is and what's having impact on her life. You still need to have a relationship with her, and that she trusts what you have to say, and trusts that you have her best health and well-being as your primary interest. But what happens, you can't sit down and have that conversation with everybody. And that's where analytics comes into play. So you can, again, I talked about risk stratification. You can figure out who needs the most help right now, and let's find them and do it. Okay, great. Now let's apply technology to help them even further. We discovered that we've got in our cohort of patients, and I'm just making this up, an organization discovers that they've got a whole bunch of patients who not only have diabetes, but also have heart failure. And oh, by the way, they also, there's a high percentage of them that are also malnourished. Technology-wise, that's where you start applying continuous glucose monitoring with, but it, somebody has to monitor it. You know, somebody, it's not, doesn't do any good just to collect the data. Somebody's got to look at that data and say, okay, yeah, we're doing good over here. Oh no, we have a problem over here. And use remote patient monitoring to check with their heart failure situations and such, in an effort to see them more often, to make sure that you're touching base. And again, trying to find problems before they happen. You might only have space to see them in your office once every 3 months, but someone can reach out and do a televisit with them, you know, once a month or every couple of weeks. Or you can use technology if they have a smartphone and a data plan to push questions out to them, you know, about how things are going, again, to try and identify problems beforehand. So, you know, utilizing technology that way. But again, it all has to be backed up by people at this point, because we don't have iRobots waiting in the wings, taking care of all this data and interacting with patients to know what to do with it.
I agree. I think people will always be a main pillar of medicine. No matter how forward thinking you are with technology, there will be learned intermediaries. So people that need to interpret the data, people that need to provide the technology, train people how to use the technology. So I like your point that it might be more of a three-legged stool with the humans, the technology, and the analytics there.
But you're spot on though, Taryn. I don't want to discount that point. In that technology and analytics makes it more scalable. It makes it so that the humans, the people providing healthcare, can do more of the right things to help more people do better.
Beautifully stated. Do you have any last thoughts or comments, maybe advice for organizations that are currently pivoting from fee-for-service to value-based care?
Here's some advice that goes really into the weeds, just real quick. If you're an organization that has been 100% fee-for-service and you've done nothing in the value-based space, and you're a primary care practice, look into the CMS program called Making Care Primary. It was new last year. I think it's great for organizations that are new to value-based care. And the reason I say that is because it emphasizes the creation of infrastructure prior to taking on risk. Part of the advice that I give folks all the time is don't try to jump right from 100% fee for service into what we would call a full risk contract, where you're now at risk for 100% of the insurance premium dollar that would be paid for medical expenses, because you're going to fail miserably, most likely, unless you're extremely lucky. There are so many different things that need to happen to move from strictly fee-for-service to an inclusion of value-based care. And in particular, I see folks try to do value-based care and trying to get results in value-based care using fee-for-service workflows and processes, which doesn't really work. You have to move from that encounter-based bill dropping mentality to an outcomes-based payment mentality. Or the other thing I see is people, well-intentioned organizations, are like, okay, you know what, this value-based care, yeah, this is really what we need to do. And so, hey, doc, in addition to what you're currently doing, we need you to do these 14 other things, because the insurance companies are going to pay us for certain activities and for different metrics that are going to get met. And so they lump stuff on top of what's happening in the old model without reprioritizing or de-implementing some of those old workflows and processes, and sort of, again, focusing then on what becomes important when you're focused on outcomes versus focused on encounters.
So two major points there was you can't just flip a switch and overnight go from fee-for-service to value-based care. It truly is a transformation which requires infrastructure and time. And the other point that you just summed up pretty nicely is you can't just dump this idea on primary care providers and say, in addition to everything you're already doing today, do more, because they only have a set number of hours in the day. They're already at max capacity.
Yeah, I actually heard somebody, this was a consultant, say out loud, I think value-based care is adding to the burnout problem in healthcare. And I said, you know, well, really? Is it value-based care that's doing it, or is it our poor management skills and our poor change management that's really doing it? And it gets back to that lumping things on top. And so I do think, I think that's a key point. And I love we use the flip the switch analogy all the time. When Katila Farley, my partner in crime with the business of primary care, we use that analogy a lot. And I think so many people, it would certainly be easier if you could do that. But any sort of transformation or change is not easy. And I also let people know that, you know, if you want to do it right, plan for 2 to 3 years. It takes that long to get everything in order before you really start moving up the value-based care spectrum.
Thank you so much for sharing your insight around value-based care. This concludes today's Lean Health Tech podcast. If you're a listener and would like to hear a certain topic covered in future episodes, please let me know by leaving a review or comment. Thanks for joining, and be sure to check out the next episode.